The Guardian.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, and 24/7 support. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer code Guardian to get 10% off.
Hello and welcome to this special edition of a Tech Weekly podcast. I'm Keith Stewart, the Guardian's games editor, and today I'll be asking the question on practically everyone's lips. What on earth can we expect from video games in 2014? No, this won't be another list of recommended forthcoming releases. Instead, I want to discover the ideas, trends and technologies that will shape the way games look and play this year. To help me, I've been joined by three industry luminaries. Eurogamer senior writer Christian Donlan. Hello, Christian.
Hello.
And game designer from Die Gute Fabrik, George Buckingham.
Hello.
And Shahid Ahmad, senior business development manager at Sony Computer Entertainment Europe. Hello, Shahid.
Hello.
So I think today what we're going to try and look at, as I said, was the sort of where we think games are going to go in terms of design. So I'm not really looking at specific titles. We just want to find out, you know, the ideas that are really going to feed into game design this year. I think one good way starting maybe is to get you all to tell me a game you're looking forward to this year and why. So let's start with Shahid.
Oh, put me on the spot. probably quite a few, actually. I'm looking forward to Super Exploding Zoo by Honey Slug,
which is a brilliant name, straight off.
I mean, the name has me. You know, you don't need much more than the name, but there's just so much fun in there. It's so irreverent and childish and just beautiful. It's just crazy fun as well. So I'm looking forward to that. I think the art style's really magical, so I'm very excited about it. There's a lot I want to say about it, and probably best if you play it.
Okay.
But I'm also looking forward to Hurricane by the same developer.
Oh, yes. Which looks
because
absolutely
it,
lovely as
it
well.
It looks, doesn't it? But I think the other thing is it doesn't try too hard to be a traditional video game. And I'm very pleased they've been given license to do something original and unique that's allowed to breathe, take its time to develop the idea. So I'm looking forward to that. I'm also looking forward to, I guess, Watch Dogs as well, which is not so indie.
Yeah, because I should probably explain to people listening that you're kind of the indie guru, the indie champion for Sony, aren't you?
Well,
it's under your remit.
I don't know about that, but indie guru makes a pleasant change from fund guru. So
okay,
so you can stick with that if you like. I do like indies and work very, very closely with a lot of them. And I think that's where a lot of the innovation is coming from. So I guess largely relevant to this discussion that we're having. But The Witness as well.
Okay,
if you're talking about one of the kings of the indie scene, that's going to be, I think, pretty surprising. I'm really looking forward to that.
Okay. Christian, what are you looking forward to this year?
I think I should start off by saying that like every year looking back at the end of a year, the game that I enjoyed the most was never a game that I saw coming. It's like you never hear the bullet which is going to hit you, as they say, people who've been shot at say anyway. The games I'm really looking forward to this year, and I realize this makes me sound like an idiot, are the games which I haven't even heard of and which I probably won't have heard of 2 minutes before someone sends me a link and I suddenly realize there's this incredible game which has just come out and I didn't even know it was being made. And that happened just the other day, in fact. As for games I do know are coming out, which I hope are going to make 2014, I'd say Quadrilateral Cowboy, which is a name I have terrible trouble saying, but yes.
You've done it. Well, who's that by?
That's by Brendan Chung of Blendo Games, who made 30 Flights of Loving and Gravity Bone and Flotilla. And these are, so I think 30 Flights is the most interesting cinematic game I've ever played, because it's a game built around editing. He uses the Quake 2 engine, I want to say, that I'm probably wrong. He uses the Quake 2 engine, which is very old and very reliable, and he could essentially do jump cuts within 3D space. So you'd be walking down a corridor and he would cut you to somewhere else. And it would create this thing. It's everything which is great about, they say about great screenwriting, is sort of enter late and leave early. I always get that the wrong way around, which is the worst.
In
enter
life
really early and leave really late. But it's just a wonderful wonderful, wonderful game. And this seems to have a lot more of that. But whereas those were slightly rollercoastery games, he's like very heavily influenced by theme park design, Brendan Cheung. Loads of theme park trickery in his games, sort of geographical, making small spaces look big and stuff like that. Although they were kind of rollercoasters, this one is actually much more mechanical than his normal games. So you're a hacker breaking into various places, and you're wandering through them in first person in these 3D environments, but at the same time, at any point, you can bring out your little computer and you can enter this language. You have to learn how to hack, basically, by typing in commands. And someone who is, A, too lazy to ever rob a bank, which is what I'd really like to do, and too lazy to learn how to code, this is the perfect game for me, because it's a little bit of both. So I'm really excited.
I like the way it's only laziness that prevents you from robbing a bank.
Oh, yeah. I've got loads of ideas. Just don't want to put
the moral conundrum just doesn't come into it. Brilliant.
But that looks absolutely wonderful, and I hope it comes out this year.
Great. Okay. And George from Die Guten Fabrik, which I've probably said wrong every single time.
You're saying it wrong differently, though. That's good.
That's what I like to hedge my bets.
Yeah, eventually, by sheer chance.
Yeah, I might stumble upon something accurate, which pretty much defines my career. Tell us a little bit. Well, what game are you looking forward to? We should start there.
So, like Kristen said, it's always the game that you're not expecting. Like, I kind of want to say, like, whatever Droken makes, like, that's going to be great. Yeah. Whatever he makes, I have no idea what he's working on at the moment, but whatever it is.
Can you tell us who he is?
So he is the person behind, he made Probability Zero, and he also made Starseed Pilgrim, and he also made, I've suddenly forgotten the name of it, but it's a two-player game where one person has a keyboard and gets to deactivate bits of the letter, and the other person gets to navigate around. So you need to work with this kind of shared...
Oh, yes. It's kind of shared cooperative gameplay with different... It's asymmetrical.
Yeah, and one person just has a map of the area, which is an unreliable map, and the other person gets to see where they actually are at the time.
Okay.
So whatever he makes is going to be interesting and special. I'm kind of keen to see that, although I have no idea what he's working on. So,
and what are you guys working on? Because I know you best as a quite an experimental games development outfit. What are you up to at the moment?
So. The company itself is due to release Swartz Friends any day now. Real soon now.
Okay.
I don't know the exact date that's scheduled for that. So Swartz Friends, which I'm massively excited for and aren't actually working on myself, so I can just be excited from the sidelines. So it's a package of four games, all of which are amazing. It feels weird to be excited for it, as I've been playing all of these games for years and have been loving them for years, but it is finally properly coming out. So it contains JS Joust, which is the game where you're running around shoving people in real life whilst they're holding move controllers.
You hold move controls and everyone has to try and knock the play the move controller of other people.
Yeah,
so they've
got to protect their own and knock other people. So it kind of becomes like this kind of dance around each other, all set to bark.
Yeah.
There's also Hokra, which is kind of a hockey game. It's a football game, not a hockey game. I keep calling it a hockey game, and Ramiro doesn't like that because it's inaccurate. And there's also Bennett's game in there.
Bennett Foddy's game.
All of those.
And so it's coming soon to
PlayStation platforms.
So let's start by looking at a series of topics which I have pre-arranged, and things that I think are going to shape games in 2014, a series of themes, and I want you all to discuss these and see if you agree with me. So I think maybe the first theme, the first thing I think is going to shape games in 2014 is the idea of procedural generation, which is the idea that either a world builds itself based on a set of predefined parameters given by the programmer. So a good example of this is Minecraft, for example. Every time you load up Minecraft, the world is procedurally generated, so it's different every time. And also, there's some developers are looking into the ideas of procedurally generated narratives as well, and stories, which I think is really interesting. So I think the idea of games almost kind of building themselves and being different every time, I think, is going to be quite important in the coming year. I don't know what you guys think. I'll open it to you.
Yes, Keith, you're right.
Excellent. Well, that's that one done then.
No, absolutely. It's vital, and I think it's really, really important. For independent developers particularly, because it allows them to scale, it gives them leverage, It's often confused with random, of course, which it isn't. You know, there are a lot of roguelike games, which I guess are very 2013. And they're probably best perceived as random. Some are a bit more procedural than others. Procedural really just means made by a human, but indirectly. And I think in the past, what's tended to happen is with procedural games is that the people who make the ideas behind the eventual building of the game are programmers. And I'm hoping that in the future we'll have psychologists, sociologists, and people who understand human behavior involved more in shaping the parameters, as you put it, but also the programming of the creation of the game world. And it doesn't just have to be, you know, traditionally it's a map, right? That's what procedurally gets generated. And if you look at No Man's Sky, it's pretty much everything. Mm. But beyond the this creation
the,
of...
Sorry, this is the forthcoming game from Hello Games based in Guildford, and it's a big space exploration game, which was announced to the Spike TV Game Awards last year.
Fantastic looking game. And I think everybody's dream, certainly every boy's dream from the 70s. But yeah, that's essentially what procedural is. But it doesn't just have to apply to objects. It can apply, as you say, to narrative. It can apply to character behavior. So that's what I'd like to see more of. And I'm pretty sure that will happen over the next couple of years. Not sure we'll get some of the top end of that happening in 2014, but we'll start to see the beginnings of it. And I think the current generation of console hardware, ignoring the other hardware, which I think is already pretty capable. So PC hardware is already very capable. But the current generation of console hardware should be able to support that. Mm. So you should be able to dynamically generate a lot more than perhaps you were able to on the previous generation. I'm very excited about it.
Yeah, I mean, at the moment, it's something which seems to be thought of as quite an indie thing to do. And obviously, Minecraft did it. No Man's Sky is an indie game as well. And partly, people have this idea that it's good for smaller teams because it allows them to build depth and epic-sized landscapes without the manpower of having to model everything. But there's also possibilities there for mainstream games as well. If you think of, sort of a world like Grand Theft Auto 5, most of that world is actually closed off to you because if the designers of Grand Theft Auto 5 were to design every single interior to every single building in Los Santos, it would take them years and years and years. Whereas if the Grand Theft Auto games started exploring procedural generation, then you could perceivably have every single interior modelled because you just set a range of parameters and then bang, the world loads up and every single house is explorable, which is kind of an interesting idea.
And yet, even in Grand Theft Auto 5, you've got this interesting subculture that's built up around people taking photos of sunsets in unusual places, which I think is absolutely amazing. So imagine if there was detail for lots more people to explore, to shape unique moments for people. What we've lost from many years ago is the ability to deliver a unique experience to people that they can then share. At the moment, what we have are experiences that are repeatable, cookie-cutter experiences that are then shared. Yes, I've seen this. Yes, I've got my trophy or achievement or whatever. Yes, I've done this. But if you've got something a lot more unique and there is no trophy, and the only way you're going to get to share it is through the modern mechanisms of sharing. I think that's really exciting. And procedural can help, I think, as you rightly say, with the AAA guys, it'll help them as well.
Yeah. Christian?
On the way to getting to that point where you get something which is unique but that you can share, I think you will fall into a trough of getting things which are unique but are not worth sharing. And I think, like, what's really interesting about a game like Spelunky, which is procedural, the same thing with Minecraft, is you said that Minecraft, each time it generates a world, is different. But each time it generates a world, it's also kind of the same in that it's chosen... It has a sweet spot for the kind of worlds it wants to make. It doesn't want to make one which is completely full of blocks, and it doesn't want to make one where there are no blocks. It wants this kind of world, which is kind of this lovely set of sort of archipelagos. And it's the same thing with Spelunky. And it comes back to that distinction that you were talking about, Shahid, about the difference between randomized games. And there's still so much authorship in a good procedural game. And Spelunky will keep turning out levels forever, and they will always be new and exciting, but they will always have that authorship to them. And I think if they can carry that across when they're getting the experience bigger... I've been playing Starbound recently, which is a bit like Terraria, but at the end of... you explore... Terraria is a 2D game. So think of it as 2D Minecraft, in a way. You drill around. You're on this elaborate world. You can drill down, you can collect ores, you can build stuff, you can craft, you can change the environment, you can explore wherever you want. But in Starbound, the idea is that then you can warp back to your ship and blast off and see another planet, a whole galaxy of other planets. And I think the challenge for them is to make that feel special each time, not just that you're going everywhere in the world and everywhere in the universe, pardon me, and everywhere is the same. So
I mean, the thing that Minecraft did really well was that kind of you went into it and you built something and you built it with your own hands and then you saw the thing you'd made and that made it really exciting. And then you really wanted to share it. And then you were suddenly like, no, wait, I built a small hut in Minecraft. Everyone's seen this already, but I'm still really excited and I'm still really, I mean, that was the real magic of it for me. It's like, and as soon as you have procedural generation, then you have to deal with all the edge cases that kind of comes along with that. And so suddenly it's like, oh, the person can, you know, blast a hole here. Suddenly that seems a lot more doable once you've got procedural generation. And that's also the exciting thing. And the same with Starbound, where it's the things that you've made or the fact that you've made it yourself that makes it exciting and makes it what you want to share.
Yeah, and Shahid, you picked up on something which I think is going to be important and tied into this, the idea of sharing. And, you know, sharing is procedural in itself. And a developer never knows what is going to be shared from their game. And that, I think that is going to be big. And we're seeing this now with the alpha release of DayZ or DayZ, which is a online open world zombie adventure game on PC. And lots of people kind of sharing their experiences this, and a lot of what is happening is player emergent behaviors. So the world is there for you to inhabit, but everything you do, from scavenging buildings to setting up gangs who then mug other players, everything that you do is prescribed by the players and is emergent. And so, you know, that's an interesting way that I think it looks like games are going to go this year. Christian?
So I just want to say something about that. And what I think, hopefully, one of my big hopes for this year is that you see a lot more of that. Because, so one of my favorite games of the last generation was Crackdown. And the reason I loved it so much is not because I want to be a slightly fascistic super cop jumping around a futuristic city.
But only because you're too lazy.
I don't mind. Yeah, only because I'm too lazy. Yeah, I can't be bothered to read all the dogma. But but because there was so little in the game, there were so few moments where the designers sort of said, I'd rather you were doing this. There was nothing they would rather I would do, because they hadn't really put much in the game for me to do. And it existed in this kind of wonderful sweet spot of emptiness, where it was just really fulfilling to do, hypnotic to go and do things which I'd made up myself. And I think you're going to hopefully see that a lot this year, in part because we're seeing a lot of early access games, which I'm sure you're going to want to come on to later, but early access games, they will ship you a build where various bits and pieces work, but the main narrative has not been plugged in yet. And often what you find, that's exactly the situation Starbound's in right now, for example. And what often you find is that is wonderful, that like the narrative sometimes, as much as I love it when it comes along, it is this intrusion which stops you from doing the things you want to do. And it seems interesting that we're seeing this a lot now, because we're playing games in very early states.
Yeah. I mean, George, I just wonder if you're... In some ways, if we're heading into a different era of game design, where authorship means providing a set of kind of subjective tools for players and then allowing them to explore them, like take DayZ, which is available as an early access thing, which people can download it from Steam. It's very buggy, but everything they do in it is up to them. Do you think the future, along what Christian's saying, is it's going to be about providing a subjective authorial landscape, but then not applying on that too much in terms of story? And
well, like as a game designer anyway, I'll make a thing, I don't know if this will work, so you show it to some people and watch them play, and then you find out whether it'll work or not. And really, this is like a way to get some money whilst you're doing that, which is lovely, because with money you can continue developing the game. But I mean, still, like that's what was existing before in terms of leaving it open to people and like testing things. And some things don't work as well with that. If you've got a story that you want to tell, you can't really test, hey, is this story any good? But what you can test is whether people are getting that story from it. And again, with early access, that doesn't really work for kind of narratively heavy games, because you want, when the great massive public hits your game, for them to see that story in the best possible light. Whereas if it's more open-ended, if you're giving people tools, then it's fine that they kind of can use some of the tools and not others, because they'll come up with cool things, and then you can learn how to improve those tools and how to make a more interesting experience. But
You think we're going to see more? I mean, do all of you think we're going to see more early access then for system-led games rather than narrative games in 2014?
Oh, God, I think it's going to be an absolute rush. I mean, there already is a rush, but I think, yeah, you're going to see it's going to be iOS all over again, I think, possibly.
Can the consoles support a form of early access development? I presume you can't because they're closed systems.
Already have a form of closed beta. We have some open betas as well that are open by invitation. So it is possible technically for them to support that kind of early access scheme.
Mm. But is that something you can imagine happening on PlayStation 4, having a game like DayZ, you know, available in an early form for people to download from PlayStation Network? Could that ever occur, or is, you know, the security ramifications must be pretty terrifying?
A lot of things have changed at PlayStation over the last few years, and I can imagine that things will continue changing. And there's a very fast-moving, very responsive space today, and we're part of that, and we want to be part of that.
Okay. All right. Okay, I won't dig any further. I want to. Okay, well, another idea that I had, which kind of obvious one, really, considering some of the games that we're seeing coming out next year, is this idea of persistent worlds, persistent online worlds. You know, games where you're not just switching on and having a limited serve with like 10 other people, and you're playing Call of Duty, and then when you finish, it's switched off, and the server's down, and you don't have a life anymore in that. What we've seen from games like World of Warcraft is this idea of a universe which functions, which stays, and when you come online, it's there, and when you go, it's still there. I think we're going to see this obviously with games like Destiny, which is the big kind of poster boy of this idea of persistence. So I think I wonder if in 2014 we're going to see lots more online games which have a world that you come in and out of, but the world exists while you're not there, and that you're going to have to adapt to that. I wonder, anyone like to come in on persistence? There's persistent silence.
I just got a 3DS for Christmas from my mother.
Are you just showing off, or is this leading
somewhere? No, this is leading somewhere. I mean, it's mainly just showing off, but anyway, so the main reason I got it was because I really wanted to play Animal Crossing, which is kind of an example of this already working. And yeah, like, I think that's also interesting. Like, so it's an example of a persistent world. I mean, it's not online. It doesn't actually update until you turn it on, and then suddenly it's like, hey, all of this stuff happened in between. But it does have this sense of it's a place that you visit as much as it's a game. And it also has this, yeah, it's a place that you visit, which is a nice thing. And it's kind of.
Yeah, exactly, Christian.
Persistence brings with it such, and Animal Crossing is a great example of it, brings with it such a new kind of anxiety that I don't associate with games normally, and I'm almost, for all, as much as I love Animal Crossing, I'm not sure I like this anxiety. And I wonder if you've had any of these moments where, in Animal Crossing, someone will say, hey, I'm going to come over to your house today at 3 o'clock. How does that sound? And before you know it, you've gone, oh, that sounds great, Leonardo, come on over. And then 3 o'clock comes around, and there's something you really have to do in the real world. Like, I'll be in an editorial meeting or something, and I'll be thinking like, okay, wrap this up, because Leonardo's coming over and I don't want to let him down. And there was an N-Gage. Does anyone remember the N-Gage game? There was a specific game where it was made by Sega, and you would Puzzle Kingdom, I think it was called. It was like a tower defense kind of game. But the idea was you would build up your defenses, and then you'd go away, and people would attack you while you were offline. And that just sounds like horrible harassment. So there is a downside to persistence in that you are missing stuff. And in games, for so long, we've been so like blessed with the designers don't want you to miss anything. It's like a Spielberg is always pointing you in the right direction through every moment. And there's this wonderful kind of fractious kind of anarchy to something like Animal Crossing, where you can miss the festival you've really been looking forward to, or the carpet salesman will come and go and you'll have been at work or something like that. So it's a new kind of, I guess I like it because it's a new kind of awful trauma I can subject myself to.
Yeah, I mean, on a lesser and maybe slightly more exploitative level, you have things like Clash of Clans, which I started playing that and I'm hopeless at it. But then, you know, for 3 days after you're last online, you're getting messages saying such and such has attacked your base. I'm thinking, and it happens like 4 or 5 times a day, and I'm thinking, is there anything left of that base?
I had an amazing story about this. So sorry, I've been monopolizing this, but I had an amazing story about this with CSR Racing, which is a racing game for iOS, well, a kind of a gear-changing game for iOS. I turned it on to see what the fuss was about, and it didn't load. It failed to load. It had like a wheel turning on the loading screen, and I thought, okay, I've got to go do something else, and I turned it off. But even though it hadn't loaded the game and I couldn't play the game, the bit which bothers you had loaded fine. And so ever since, I just kept getting these texts from this game, which I'd never played, going, oh, you know, it's about street racers and, like, you know, Big Boy Sam thinks you're a massive idiot or something. And I'm like, what? Well, he's dissing your car. And I was like, what car? And who is he? And will you leave me alone?
Oh, my God. It's like having some sort of sentient
but
Twitter.
That was the game to me, was just being horribly abused by something I had... People I had never met who were abusing things I didn't own. It was...
That's a bit like calling someone, realizing you've got the wrong number, and them doing caller ID and stalking you forever.
Yeah, except you can give them 69p every now and then.
But is there, I mean, away from Christian's nightmare with CSR racing, is there what are the values to persistent worlds in the online space then? Because there is the possibility, because a lot of what we do in online worlds is create things and fight other people. If you're not online, you can't fight them, and if you've created anything, then it's vulnerable. And then you get into all these situations, which I hate with World of Warcraft, where everything is sectioned off. So you have a P versus P area and a P versus E area. It means nothing to me. But the idea of a totally free landscape, which I find fascinating, is also, you know, George, for a game designer, must be a nightmare to think about. How can you create a world which people aren't terrified to leave, in a way, just in case anyone wrecks their house or burgles their shop? Or,
well, I mean, you can also just make that kind of part of the game in the way like Castle Doctrine is exactly that. Like, you build a house and then people come and try to rob it whilst you're offline, and the entire game is building up your fortifications so that they die if they try to rob it, or they, you know, get eaten by a guard dog or something. And then when you're online, you go and try to rob other people's and see if you can get through. So
yeah, which is the same as which is similar to Ubisoft's game Mighty Quest for Epic Loot. A similar sort of concept, in that you build a dungeon and then allow people to try to get in there.
Yeah, exactly. And it's, I mean, I don't know. Yeah, I mean, basically that's kind of the classic game designer thing of seeing, hey, there's this idea, it sounds cool, but there's this problem with it. Okay, let's make the game around the problem. And that way it'll all be good.
Another thing which I think is obviously going to be very big this year, because it's already been very hyped, is the idea of seamless single co-op multiplayer experiences. So I think this is something we first started to see with Demon's Souls and Dark Souls, this idea of being able to infiltrate or somehow inhabit someone else's single player experience, because game consoles are always online now and your PC is always online, so elements of someone else's game can kind of transfer into yours. This is going to happen with Destiny. All the multiplayer action, all the co-op action comes out, branches seamlessly from the single-player campaign. So you're a space captain exploring the universe, but you can bump into other players within this universe, and you can all take on a task together. And there's also going to be kind of multiplayer, I think, competitive multiplayer worlds within the Destiny universe. We saw this. We saw some very interesting ideas of infiltration into other people's single-player games in Demon's Souls, and that's going to happen in Watch Dogs as well, which is Ubisoft's kind of cyberpunk thriller adventure, where often you might get into a side quest against what you think is a non-player character, a computer-control character, but what the game has actually done is, for that instance, for that mission, has brought someone in, another real player from the real world, who then plays the baddie in your game just for that moment. So, I mean, has this got legs? Is this an interesting idea for 2014? Are we going to see more of it? This idea of seamlessness between single and multiplayer and co-op?
It's certainly a design challenge, isn't it? I think one of the things I like about its application in AAA is that it gives you the opportunity to enjoy an immensely rich world in more ways than one. We haven't seen enough of that in the past. I think the last time I ever saw that successfully done, from the early days, was Swiv and Silkworm, where you could play either the helicopter or the tank, and one was not quite as strong as the other, so it's kind of asymmetrical support, but very weak. Whereas I think what you're going to see in modern games is that it's not about weakness at all. It's about providing variety, it's about providing interest, and it's about being able to see a world in a completely different way.
Well, we do see a lot in first-person shooters. If you take Call of Duty, which some of you may have heard of, the multiplayer experience is so different from the single player experience, because the single player experience is all about working out exactly what the AI wants to do in any set situation and completely exploiting and destroying that, whereas that can never happen in a multiplayer game because people are fundamentally unpredictable. And so I really like the idea of single player games using some of that unpredictability, because AI is so vastly complex to get right. I just wonder, allowing other players into a single player experience to sort of provide a more interesting enemy, is that a sort of an interesting prospect for game designers, George, even though your games are very, very different?
No, I mean, so I was just thinking, the first game I made was actually this idea. It was like a really simple thing, but it was a game where it was a shmup, but everyone who played previously, the path they'd taken kind of squiggling around and shooting was recorded, and then those were the ships you were fighting against.
Okay.
Which was, you know, just because I was too lazy to do AI or write interesting kind of enemy patterns that I thought this could be an easy way to get around that, and all you have to do is put up a little bit of a web service, which could do reasonably easily. So yeah, I mean, there's interesting stuff there, but it's hard to apply generally, or you need to design stuff around it. And like, there's stuff where it's worked really well, like Journey is the main example I kind of think of there, where like you get all these stories of people getting to the end and being like, oh yeah, the AI was really good in Journey. And again, that's also even does it even better in terms of you don't realize that the other players coming in, it just seamlessly connects you and does that without that kind of stuff. And I mean, I guess maybe that's the main problem with multiplayer, that is kind of, this is almost working around, is just getting around lobby systems,
which is
just kind of awful experience for everyone involved. So it's a way to have multiplayer and to get that kind of joy, the kind of, I mean, because like multiplayer is kind of richer and more exciting because you're fighting with a real person, like the stakes automatically matter more because it's not just you versus a computer. And it's a way to get that without the kind of faff and administrative overhead of it, but instead just kind of slip it in and kind of add it to places and kind of the interesting places you can add it to without needing to just make it about that.
Yeah. Okay. Well, let's move on from that. Let's get on to something slightly more different now. I'm wondering if I can bring in... combine two of these together. And George, before we actually came into the studio today, you were talking about interactive fiction and some of the interesting things that are happening there. And what we've seen over the last kind of couple of years is this idea of things like Twine, game development systems like Twine. Twine is a way of building interactive fiction. It almost allows you to make your own choose your own adventure book spot online, and that it's very easy to use. It's a very usable system, and pretty much anyone can pick it up, create very simple text-based adventure games or very profound and complex adventure games, and then make them easily available for anyone else to play. So interactive fiction is something that's become to the forefront in 2013. And do you see it evolving in some way in 2014?
Like, so Twine has been massively exciting the last while, and it feels like it's reaching a point where it's to a certain extent mature. Like it's like the form has kind of developed out and formed all these kind of branches and all these kind of interesting things you can do with it, which have kind of sprung off, like Christine Loves, Even Cowgirls Bleed, where you're not clicking on a thing, you're moving a crosshair around, and when you mouse over a link, you shoot it because you're a clumsy cowgirl who shoots everything she sees. And like, there's a bit where you have to maneuver the cursor carefully between like rows of links representing like crockery and stuff in order to reach the right link for it. And if you're just clumsy, and it's still basically a text-based game, it's still, you're just reading text, and it's kind of interesting where that kind of explores off. I mean, like 5 years ago, if you said interactive fiction, it was pretty much only The Parser, and no one really played that, no one really cared about it. It was kind of a small community still making kind of, you know, old Infocom style games, but it was kind of a dying thing, and now suddenly it's exploding and everyone's kind of into that, and there's lots of other really interesting approaches to interactive fiction aside from Twine, which are also kind of taking off, like Versu, which is a iOS app that you can get, which is kind of a social simulation, again conducted entirely through text and entirely through kind of choices, and it's kind of it's great for simulating Pride and Prejudice, like doing a scene from Pride and Prejudice where characters have motivations and they can say different things and you can kind of progress through the story that way, and they have different motivations, they can do different actions in it, and it generates the story from that versus having entirely pre-written dialogue. So that's kind of one other approach on the other side of Twine. And then there's all kind of stuff like Fall in London, which I think might be called Echo Bazaar now.
Which way? I think, isn't it called Fallen London now?
Okay. Anyway,
it's the other way around, yeah.
Okay, yeah. So Fallen London, which is, again, a kind of persistent multiplayer online thing where you're just clicking through options and it's you're choosing options from that, and you've got kind of different stats, but you're going online and you're seeing this kind of wonderful world that they've created. And again, that's kind of all text-based. Mm. And then it's even leaking into kind of indie games like Kentucky Route Zero, like... is basically in some places like a text adventure with pretty graphics in it. I mean, it's actually a 3D game and you're walking around in it, but it's not afraid to just go off and be a text adventure for 5 minutes in it because it's about the text and it's about the story. And so I'm excited to see all the other weird ways that kind of really narratively heavy stuff can kind of come out.
Yeah, yeah. And Shahid, do you see a future in which we've seen story becoming a more complex and important part of mainstream games? You know, lots of people point to Last of Us as being really strong narratively, but it's still kind of quite conventional. It's still very action based. Do you see story and the idea of interactive narrative becoming a bigger thing on console games, on really big games? Do you see story really guiding and being expressive in bigger games rather than just being something which is explored through cinematic cutscenes?
I certainly hope so. I think it will help if we allow people to make much shorter games. I think the closest I've come to playing any kind of interactive narrative this year is probably Castles in the Sky. Probably doesn't count, but to me, it was much more about the reading, and it allowed me to relax into the very, very simple mechanic and enjoy what was going on. And that was, what, 10 minutes, 11 minutes? Mm. And a complete experience for me from beginning to end allowed me to feel a whole range of emotions. How many people are going to be brave enough to make 10-minute, 15-minute games for a console, I wonder? That'll be interesting to see. We certainly made it easier for them. Some of the restrictions that we used to have about having to go through concept approval and so on, you know, and requiring a certain amount of gameplay, they don't exist anymore. So I think it'll take some time for this kind of news to filter out and people begin to realize they're able to make that kind of thing. But then beyond that, it's a case of educating the audience. I mean, Mike Bithell talks to me about Twine all the time, and I'm wondering how will the mass market respond to Twine Adventures delivered over PlayStation 4, for example, you know, if that facility existed. And the truth is, I haven't a clue. But I think it will take indies to make that happen and to experiment, because they'll be willing to take that chance.
Mm. Okay.
Oh, George. I mean, I'm curious to see how well Depression Quest does, as it's recently got greenlit. It's the first Twine game on Steam.
Wow.
Mm. Okay. Well, tell us about Depression Quest.
So Depression Quest is a Twine game. It's basically kind of a depression simulator. It kind of plays that quite straight. You're just a person with depression, kind of struggling with that, and you're just given like everyday situation, and you're given a list of options. But as you, depending on how depressed you are, and depending how far you sank into it, kind of the, you know, sensible options like there's a party with your friends are there, it's going to be good, like your girlfriend's there as well. What do you go to it, or do you sit in your bed at home and fail to go? Do you call your girlfriend and say you can't go, or do you just sit there and ignore everything? And as you sink further into depression, like the happier options, the more sensible options are just crossed off because you just can't face them. And so it kind of, just by that simple mechanic, manages to emulate that experience of depression really well.
Yeah, which I think counters this idea which has come up in the past about games just being about fun and having fun. And I've got into a recent argument or discussion with a colleague, another writer on The Guardian, about this. And you know, one of the points I made was that although a lot of games are fun and are predominantly about fun, games are a form of expression and a form of communication. And Depression Quest and another game we're going to see this year is That Dragon Cancer as well, are games which try to communicate to the world an experience, a real experience, and do so in a way that literature and movies maybe can't, because they are interactive and because you get to experience them as well.
Do you remember the Mel Crowther game? Was it called ID or IQ? The very old game. I suppose it'd be classed as interactive fiction, but it was almost like a Turing test where you were asking you were interrogating an AI on the other side of the computer screen. Yes. This must have been a Spectrum game.
Yeah,
or something
Spectrum
like that.
And Commodore, I think it was.
And that was like that kind of interrogative interactive fiction seems really exciting. The kind of you think of interactive fiction a lot of the time. At least me, I don't play a lot of Twine games, and I am very ignorant about it. And when someone says interactive fiction, I do tend to think of Choose Your Own Adventure. But you forget there is this kind of, like the idea of having a interactive fiction being a dialogue where you're trying to understand who the other person is, or, you know, stuff like that. Kind of Turing test stuff, I think, sounds very promising as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
Do you think that this kind of game would work on a console? Do you think the console audience would buy interactive fiction?
I mean, personally, I do. I think it's about, in some ways, in probably some ways, for a larger audience, it's going to be about how presentation, I guess, isn't it? If you take something on think of Sumogo's Device 6, which is effectively a piece of interactive fiction for the iOS platforms, and it's a beautiful game and it's very respected. But the way it presents the fiction is really, really beautiful. It's a beautiful looking game. Yeah. And I wonder if, I know it's a really simplistic way of thinking about it, but I think maybe the problem with PlayStation 4 is that there will be a perception and preconception of what games should look like on the console. And if you can work within that, then, you know, I think there's possibilities there. I think Journey showed, we keep name-checking Journey, but I think Journey was very ahead of its time in the bravery that that game company showed, in that they presented this world without a narrative and allowed players to explore it together in a very forward-looking way and allowed them to make the story themselves. And I think, and that was so beautifully presented, people felt comfortable in that space.
I think what's really important about Device 6 is, I mean, it works so well in your hand. It because it has this kind of 60s typography thing, it really feels Kindle-like in a certain kind of way, or like what I wish Kindles looked like. But the other thing that's really interesting is the audio is exceptionally brilliant and kind of weaved in really beautifully. And I think what would kill interactive fiction, I can imagine playing interactive fiction on like the Xbox 360 or something like that, and it having kind of Archer's style sound effects, like, you know, kind of awful, like, you know, the door opening and closing that they always have in Archer's and that kind of thing. And you have to take the whole package has to be taken as seriously, I think.
Yeah. It'd be great to have the facility to make your own sound effects for the game.
I thought you were going to say it'd be great to make an Archer's interactive fiction. Yeah. I'll let myself out.
Yeah. I know this is The Guardian, but I'm not that Guardian. Okay, well, actually another one, an interesting one actually, George brought up simply so that he could flag up his own event that he's organising. Actually, I don't know, hang on, cut. When are we going out on the air? Next Wednesday. Oh, you can't then.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. But there'll be other Wild Rumpuses, aren't
there?
There will
be other Wild Rumpuses.
Okay,
yeah.
Okay. I'll start that bit again, Jason. Okay, something else that came up just before, that George was talking to me just before we came in to record this, was the idea of installation games, which are games obviously you won't be able to play on a PlayStation or a PC or a console at home, but that you have to go out to and are specifically made objects. Which may include a screen, may not. And George, you think this may become a thing. I mean, I've played lots of them at places like Game City and Wild Rumpus, which is a regular... Well, you explain Wild Rumpus because you're an organiser.
So Wild Rumpus is this event that we're putting on that, in fact, when this is going out, will have happened last Saturday. So sorry if you missed it. I can't do anything. That's the way time works.
God damn you, time.
But it's a night of like kind of mainly local multiplayer games and other kind of games that are best experienced with a crowd around you, and also drinking and also DJing. We've got Kozilek, who does the music for a lot of the Vlambeer games. He's coming along and doing a live set for us. And we've got we will have had a caravan that people have done to be like a spaceship cockpit inside. It's a spaceship cockpit simulator. Where you get to actually fiddle the knobs and get to be under attack and
in a caravan.
In a caravan.
Wow. Yeah.
But the entire thing is done up so, like, so the entire interior kind of works with that. And like there's a kind of fog machine that comes in, and at a certain point you get hit and a panel falls open, and you have to go up to the panel and plug the wires back together in order to fix the ship before you anything will work again.
Wow, it's like Millennium Falcon.
Yeah.
So, but you do more, these are reasonably regular, or you do like 3 or 4 a year, don't
yeah,
you?
Exactly. So you can do it again. I mean, if you're in Toronto, there's one in about a month's time. So if you're in Toronto, otherwise. Okay.
But I guess, I mean, it doesn't just have to be. I think what we should draw from that is the idea of local multiplayer, maybe.
Yeah.
Because so, I think installation games are really interesting. If you can get something like Game City, if you can get to Wild Rumpus, if you can get to even E3, they're coming up now in the Indiecade. If you can get to one of these events, brilliant. It's a great way of exploring interactivity in an unusual way. But maybe what we can take from that in a wider context is the idea of local multiplayer, which has kind of fallen out of favour. Because as online gaming has kind of grown immensely in popularity, the idea of people sitting around the same screen or the same peripherals and playing together in one room has kind of, apart from the brief spurt of interest and popularity in like music games, has become less popular. Is that, do you see that being revived? Do you see local multiplayer, the idea of people gathering around a screen in their homes and playing games together and having friends around to play games? Shahi, do you think that's so?
I mean, Samurai Gun's coming to PlayStation, and that came about as a result of me getting dragged at the last GDC by a whole bunch of indies to go and see Bo's game, and it's actually at your stand. And I played it with 3 other people, completely, again, dragged on to play. And,
what is it? Can you describe it?
Samurai Gun, four-player, local. You've got 3 bullets, you've got a sword, you can deflect bullets, and it's exceptionally brutal, exceptionally quick, unforgiving, merciless, and it's got some beautiful touches. So, for example, if you end up in a draw, you face each other off in the sunset, and duel to the death. It's a magnificent game, and the thing I think that it's got going for it that very few other people get is this idea that everything has to be done in a split second. Absolutely everything. All of the controls are so finely tuned. The feeling of the characters moving about is magnificent, and of course everybody shares in that. Now, you don't really get to appreciate this if you're playing this on your own, but everybody having those same brutal limitations, I think, lets you enjoy it in a matter of, I don't know, I think it was 10-15 seconds before I realised this was brutally addictive.
Is it all happen on screens and with it's, standard?
It's all on the same screen. Yeah. I mean, it's incredibly simplistic, and you don't expect it to be so much fun. You know, years and years of Call of Duty, you would have thought, would have kind of beaten that out of me, and it hadn't, and it was fantastic. It took me back to my SNES days and playing Street Fighter 2 Turbo with 2 players at a time, which I guess in the arcades was the closest you got to a public local co-op. Sorry, not co-op at all, the exact opposite, in fact. But I really do hope these games do make a revival. I do like social games. I do like having a lot of people in the same room enjoying the same thing. I'm kind of personally a little tired of aggression against people who are remote, because there's a little bit of humanity that's lost. But if you have that aggression in a very fun way with people that you love who are around you, or people that you don't know who are around you, it becomes a sharing experience. And it's one where, you know, maybe you grudgingly accept somebody else kind of beating you savagely and you're still all right about it, instead of feeling the need to swear at them aggressively or whatever.
Yeah, because you have that, you share a physical space, and therefore it's a lot more personal.
Exactly. Yeah. And, you know, it's very, very hard to be so rude to people, to their face as well. So I think it's a good thing. I think societally it's a good thing as well.
Well, you're the opposite of Margaret Thatcher.
Maybe. Excellent. So Samurai Gun's one, Towerfall's another. And I think it's interesting that you've got these games that are so intensely competitive, but in which people who are in a closed, confined space can have so much fun.
Yeah. Another aspect, I guess, Christian, I'll bring in, you've just written an astonishingly good feature about Monopoly for Eurogamer. And if you're listening to this and you haven't read Christian's feature about Monopoly and the prison camps and World War II,
yeah, good times,
and the combination between them.
It looks like I asked you to say that before we came in. Can you just mention this feature that I've just written?
Yeah. Yeah, the packet of tenors is still warm in my back pocket.
The top pocket. I like to then pat on the shoulder as well.
But it is a great feature. But why I bring that up now is because there seems to be a growing crossover between card games and board games and video games. And I think we're seeing, obviously, Hearthstone, which is the really good card game by Blizzard. I want to say Blizzard.
Yes.
I want to say it because it's right. And there's lots of others. And essentially, board games as well seem to be really rising in popularity with gamers and also informing a lot of video game design as well. And I wondered, with your expertise from your Monopoly feature, what you thought of that.
Talking about the Monopoly feature, one thing that's really interesting is how much it is popular to diss Monopoly as a bad piece of game design, and how I did read some of the comments on the Monopoly piece and some of the Twitter stuff, and it is just people going, I hate Monopoly, I really hate Monopoly, I play it every Christmas and I hate it, and I play it every Christmas and I love it, because I think what's interesting about Monopoly is it is not a particularly brilliant piece of game design. It has this terrible flaw that if you get the oranges you are going to win, but getting the oranges...
I didn't know that.
It's because people roll to get out of prison. So, the oranges. If you... Oranges, and it wouldn't kill you to own the train stations. That's what I'm saying.
Thank you.
So,
I'm looking forward to Christmas.
So, is this 2014 for us then?
But what is so brilliant about Monopoly is that in terms of getting the oranges, the game takes place off the board. The game is about being horrible or about maintaining kind of a low-level psychological torture with the people you're playing with, sometimes being really nice to them, and then sometimes, like hair trigger, turning into a monster to get what you want, to kind of unnerve people into making... You think, well, I better make a deal with this guy. I better give him my spare orange because he's turned into a sociopath during the course of this game. And that is the thing which is very hard for non-local multiplayer games to actually get into, the social warmth and the social richness which is there. In we were talking about Joust before we came in, and how I saw people playing Joust and I assumed they'd known each other for forever and they had never met before, and it's just there is that social warmth of local multiplayer games which is really hard to capture. And Hearthstone, as much as I love it, Hearthstone is the thing you're talking about, the kind of the drone warfare, like long distance multiplayer. You get someone's name, you never talk to them, you never see them again, you nuke them or they nuke you and the game's over. Whereas I think the rise of the board games coming back is just so exciting to have that whole dynamic which games allow for, which is not part of the game system itself. I've played... has anyone played Ladies and Gentlemen here?
No.
Oh, it's this incredible German board... I think it's German board game where you divide into groups of two. You divide into couples, and in each couple there is a man and a woman. And the man goes to work in stock market, and the woman goes shopping. And it sounds like... It sounds terribly gendered, and it is, but it's actually sort of making fun of that. And it's making fun of that by really putting you into that situation. You're each doing something completely different. So you're each playing a separate game, and then at the end of the day you have to come home and say, darling, how much money did you make at the stock market, because I found this pair of shoes I'd really like to buy. And there's something about that just wouldn't work online. And I think again, coming back to Christmas, I was with my nieces a bit, and every game you play with young children is local co-op stroke local competitive, even if it's a single player game. Because I remember this being a kid and watching my brother play on the Commodore 64 at the same time. The moment when you don't have the controller is still, you have to make the most of it, so you kind of get into it at the same time. So every game they play, every single player game they play, they're playing Disney Infinity a lot, and it is inherently cooperative, and there's something about local playing with people around you which is just really great.
Yeah, I mean, I wonder if this can be, if there's something about that, bringing it back to 2014 and going ahead in terms of technology, is there a way of bringing that sense of intimacy and companionship in from a remote server? I mean, obviously now, you know, every single laptop has a camera on it, every single iOS device has a camera on it, now all the consoles have a camera on it. Can you bring that physicality in, Christian?
Sorry, it just made me think of, has anyone played Mirror Moon EP?
Yeah, I have.
Right, yeah. So Mirror Moon is about as single player as you can get, in that it's, oh god, if like I had a template for what I would like games to be like in 2014, I would choose Mirror Moon, because it's a space exploration game, but it starts you off in this cockpit, all of these buttons and dials, and it doesn't tell you what any of them mean. You have to work out what all of them mean. You go down to this planet, you work out the rules of how this game works, and then you are basically allowed to go through this galaxy map, going traveling from one planet to the other, and there's a mystery, a gentle mystery for you to solve. And you really, even though it's a single player game, you start to realize you cannot solve this mystery on your own. And as you, well, the first, basically you realize you're playing through this galaxy separately, but at the same time as everyone else. And the first person to land on a planet and capture an orb on it gets to name it. And so whenever you go back to the galaxy map, loads of the first time I played it was when everyone was playing. It was really early on in its release. I'd go back to the galaxy map and loads of the planets around me had been named while I was exploring. And it was, it's this, it's, and then you have to go online. Inevitably, you go online and you're trying to talk to other people. You're trying to work with them to find out this solution to the mystery of the game. And it was this beautiful analogy for like for what you want in all the big science fiction books of the 70s, what you want space travel to be like. You know, we're all alone and we're reaching out and forging these little connections. And can you help me with this and that and stuff?
Uh-huh. So the future of gaming is Star Trek meets chat roulette.
The secret of the secret of cooperative, really satisfying cooperative gaming is being on your own.
Shahid, with the camera and PlayStation, I mean, obviously sharing is with PlayStation 4 has become a big idea, the idea of being able to share footage. But what about the fact that if you buy the PlayStation Eye camera, it's there in front of you? Obviously Kinect is there whether you want it there or not. Do you think there's a facility there for us to bring about this idea of treating other gamers as human beings, and not, you know, remote voices shouting swear words at you?
It's interesting. I mean, many years ago, it was very, very difficult to provide kind of full embodied remote experience because of bandwidth limitations. And now kind of bandwidth limitations are disappearing. It's possible to share camera feeds and thus our partnership with Twitch and so on, and the ability to stream gameplay and even visuals from people's bedrooms, and therein lies a problem, because part of sharing invites the possibility of creating things that aren't suitable for everyone to watch and share, and so moderation becomes a real issue. And moderation is an issue not just for us but for a lot of large companies who permit sharing of all kinds of data. So it's, as well as an opportunity, it's a problem. So they both need to work hand in hand. We need to find people who can tackle both, and it's not cheap to tackle both, because moderation is something that doesn't scale very well. You know, you just need to put a lot of people behind it to make it really work and make sure everyone has a nice, safe experience. Because imagine, and you're playing a multiplayer game, and someone says something that you don't like. I mean, it's not very nice. But if they were physically shouting it at you and you could see the camera stream, you know, even less nice. So it's important for us to offer a lot of experiences. And part of that means you're not always going to enjoy yourself. Sometimes you're going to feel uncomfortable, but we never want that to cross the line. Mm. So that's part of our responsibility as a platform, to make sure that people have some degree of safety. But also to provide creators with the ability to stretch those boundaries a bit. It'll be an interesting challenge. Mm. And I'm sure a lot of people are working on that.
Well, I think, I mean, we're drawing to a close now, I guess, but I think, and you can all disagree with me if you like, but I think some of what we've said here is that it feels to me as though there is a transfer of authority or responsibility for the game experience from the game designer to the player. I feel as though we're heading into an era where game design is about facilitation rather than sort of directing gameplay. It's about providing tools and providing a scenario and an environment in which the players can create their own experiences and moderate their own experiences. I think that's where, you know, ultimately maybe we're going to see the tip of that in 2014, but that feels very much to me in a lot of ways like the future of games. It's going to be about that passing of the creative baton from the designer to the player. Do you agree, George, or do you think that's nonsense because you're a designer?
No, I think that's going to happen. But I mean, it's when you talk about like passing that kind of responsibility on, it's still not passing that responsibility on, because that responsibility still rests with the game designer. Like, game design is always a collaboration, right? It's always between you and the player. It's a rubbish game where you just say exactly what happens in it. So that's always kind of there, and you I don't know, like, game designers don't get to pass the buck that easily, basically.
Maybe it's more like a body swap comedy. Yeah. You've got to slightly change roles.
But allowing people the space just to say, hey, here's something, like, play with it, and, like, letting games be half finished and letting that, the unfinished bit be filled in with, like, community and players doing interesting and broken things with it. That sounds massively exciting to me.
Mm. Christian, does that sound exciting to you?
Yeah, I think it's like everything. There's got to be a balance with it. I mean, like, I'm thinking about Where Is My Heart, which is by De Groot Fabrique,
right? Yeah.
Which is a wonderful, like, the collaboration between player and designer for that is like learning about this, how this extraordinarily beautiful game works, and going looking at all the wonderful things they've put in it. And it feels more, that's the sort of design which I associate with Nintendo, whereas Nintendo, I love their games, and one of the things I've realized over the last couple of years is that they're not big on the idea of player freedom per se. They would rather, here is a bunch of things we have made for you which we are pretty sure you're going to enjoy, and we've worked out all of the things you're going to do with them, and we think they're all pretty good, so have a go. I may be wrong, but that's certainly what I got from the playing the last few games they made, and they were great. But yeah, as long as we survive, as long as that stuff survives alongside the other stuff, which is like the freedom of expression stuff, I'm very happy with collaborations, I think.
Okay, Shahid, what do you see as the future of games then? If we look, what was 2014 going to tell us?
I think we're going to see an increase in the conductor side of design. I think I'm not talking about bus conductors either. In the past, you had art forms where you had a clear divide between the composer and the conductor, or the choreographer, if you like. And I think what you have with game designers is that the game designer is a composer and the choreographer and conductor. And I think what you're seeing now is that the choreographer and conductor is feeding back to the composer while the composer is composing, and you're going to see that accelerate, I think.
Okay, Shahid, Christian and George, thank you so much for joining me today. Thank you. So that's all we have time for today on this very special edition of the Tech Weekly podcast. My name's Keith Stewart. My producer today was Jason Phipps. And if you want to read more about games on The Guardian, please come to theguardian.com and go to technology/games. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, drag-and-drop tools, and 24/7 support. Squarespace also offers seamless e-commerce solutions for you or your small business. Every design automatically includes a unique mobile experience that matches the overall style of your website, so your content will look brilliant on any device. Start your free trial today, no credit card required. As a Guardian podcast listener, you'll get 10% off your new account by using the offer code Guardian.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.